So over the last couple of days, Sayadaw has given you complete traditional instructions in the metta practice and quite a lot of information about the metta itself. These are the traditional instructions offered here in Myanmar. And Sayadaw is coming from this place of basic understanding of the process, of the practice, of the context of this practice in the whole of the teachings. He assumes you already know a lot about the teachings. Burmese beginners and Western beginners, we come from different places. So today I want to begin the gradual process that Ariya and I will undertake here of filling in the blank spaces, the places where a little more explanation is useful. So today I want to back up a little bit to offer you some context about the process of the practice and about how to work with difficult mind states in the context of the metta practice. And I want to begin today with a couple of verses from the Dhammapada, which express quite beautifully the importance of being able to cultivate the heart and to direct it, as we are doing here with the metta practice. These are verses 42 and 43 of the Dhammapada. The Buddha says, "More than a thief, more than an enemy, a misdirected heart brings one to harm. Neither mother, father, nor any member of a family can give you the blessings generated by your own well-directed heart." So these two verses are a pair, a contrast, contrasting the misdirected heart, the heart directed to greed, hatred, and delusion, and the harm that comes from that, and the well-directed heart, the heart directed to non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, and the blessings, the deep blessings that come from that, that are deeper than any blessings that we can receive from the outside. And much of the point, and I would say the entire point of this metta practice, is to direct the heart in a wholesome direction, towards benevolence, towards open-hearted friendliness and well-wishing for all living beings. And this is the metta that Sayadaw and we are talking about. And when we cultivate this metta, this friendly benevolence, as we do here in this practice, it's a different path than the Vipassana path, but it's no less powerful. So I want to begin tonight by way of context by speaking a little bit about the Vipassana path and the metta path, how they're different, how they're similar. As you know, the Vipassana practice, the Vipassana path, is a development of insight, using moment to moment mindful awareness of whatever is arising as its basis. We pay attention to whatever objects arise as they arise and pass away. We don't direct the attention to any one fixed point. This is Vipassana, insight, practice. By contrast, the metta practice is a samatha practice, a concentration practice. And the focal difference between these two is that in a samatha practice and in the metta practice, we direct the attention to a fixed place, a fixed point. There are many, many different samatha practices described in the texts. In the Visuddhimagga, it describes 40 or so different samatha practices, metta being one of them. And the fixed point in this metta practice that we direct the mind to over and over and over again is, as you know, the being for whom we're radiating loving kindness and the phrase and the meaning of that phrase. Over and over and over again, we bring the mind back to these places. So it's a fundamental difference, the samatha path and the vipassana path. And within the different forms of samatha meditation, metta is unique in that it actually develops the loving kindness. Many samatha practices use neutral objects like a kasina, light, the anapana, the in-breath and the out-breath. They use these objects as a focal point. But with the metta practice, it's like we say in English vernacular, it's a twofer. You get two for the price of one. You not only develop the concentration by bringing the mind back over and over and over again, but you're also developing the loving kindness. So we develop both the concentration, and we direct the heart over and over and over again to this well-wishing that is developed by repeating the phrase and connecting with the meaning of that phrase, really meaning what we're saying, not just may I be well, happy, and peaceful, may I be well, happy, and peaceful, may I be well, happy, and peaceful, but may I be well, happy, and peaceful, really connecting with this while wishing. So as a concentration practice, it has a double benefit. And the dual development of metta, this concentration and the metta well-wishing, comes with its own particular challenges. And we, or Sayadaw, will have more to say about how the concentration is developed in this practice and the challenges of that, of balance. But for now, it's really enough to just know this basic context. There's vipassana, there's samatha, and within the samatha practice, this metta practice is unique in that it develops both concentration and metta. Many people say, and a number of you have already said in your interviews today and connecting with us yesterday, that it can be a challenge if you're very familiar with the vipassana practice to now begin to cultivate loving kindness, to cultivate metta, to engage in this samatha practice. We get a lot of messages about the value of vipassana that are all completely legitimate, really, honestly. And we take them in a certain way often so that we become vipassana purists. You know, only the vipassana is good enough. Oh, I don't want to do this metta. It's not as good as. And we hear, oh, the vipassana leads to freedom. The metta just leads to concentration. So we can really consciously or subconsciously prefer the Vipassana. And as a result of this, often at the beginning of the metta practice, there can be quite a lot of resistance to shifting the form of the practice, to engaging in a different kind of practice. And I have to say, from my own experience, I went through quite a long time of thinking this practice was, well, quite honestly, stupid. I had a lot of resistance to the metta practice. My teachers told me to do it. I didn't want to do it. I wanted only to do Vipassana. And I was told, no, you do metta. And you keep doing metta until we tell you to stop. And that was months, actually. And by the time they told me to stop, I had been converted, I had really deeply understood the value of this practice and where it goes. And there's more to say about the value and where that goes later. But just to say, I deeply understand, and we deeply understand, if you are feeling resistance to this practice, if you're feeling that preference for the Vipassana practice. But really, it's helpful to think of this samatha practice, this metta practice, as a different doorway into the Dhamma, a different path to the peak of Mount Nibbana, so to speak. The Vipassana path comes up on one side, the metta path comes up on the other. You see different things along the way. They go in the same direction. Another metaphor that I find really useful is different languages, learning a new language. And this is very much the process when we begin to practice metta bhavana, if we've never done it before, and if we've done a lot of Vipassana practice. The mind has developed a habit of cultivating moment-to-moment awareness of the rising and falling of the feet, of our bodily movements and actions. And we ask it to do something different here. We ask it to just simply come back to this phrase, to the meaning, to the being for whom we're cultivating loving kindness. And it keeps slipping out of that back into awareness. Just like when we're learning a new language, we slip back into our mother tongue because that's what we're used to. And so for a while, it's kind of messy. You know, we'll start a sentence in one language and end it in another. I experienced this a lot here in Burma. And it particularly comes out if I'm trying to speak my second language, which is French, and what comes out is half French and half Burmese because I'm learning a third language, or actually a fourth, and it gets all very confusing. And the mind is not stable in these new languages. So it slips back to English. It slips back to what it knows, out of the unfamiliar. And it's not that any one language is any better than any other language. They're just different languages, just like these practices are different practices. They're just different habits. If you think of them in terms of cultivating a practice habit, both Vipassana practice and metta practice are good practice habits, but they're different. So in any case, whether we're speaking about language or speaking about practice, it's to be expected that we slip back into these old habits. So not to create a problem around this, or to judge yourself about this, or to think you're not doing it right, or to think you're failing, or to think you can't do it, or whatever thoughts might be coming up about this. This is normal. And really just patiently continue to direct the mind to the metta. Just to come back to that simple, single point of focus. May I be well, happy, peaceful. May I be well, happy, peaceful. Connecting with yourself, connecting with your benefactor. Whenever you know and become aware that you've wandered off to Vipassana or something else, just come back. So we develop this different habit, this different practice, the samatha practice of metta bhavana. And there's a lot more to be said about the interaction of wisdom and concentration, of metta and vipassana. But one thing I want to add here is, as you develop the metta bhavana, as you continue the metta bhavana, you're not abandoning mindfulness. So don't worry that your mindfulness muscles will get weak, because you can't successfully cultivate metta without mindfulness. And in fact, the other way around, you can't successfully cultivate vipassana without a ground of metta. I'll say more about that a little later. In the context, though, of the metta practice, what cultivates mindfulness is this, we keep saying this word connection, connect with the phrase, connect with the meaning. This is the faculty of mindfulness. This is what you need when you're doing this, being aware of what this phrase means, being aware of the person for whom you're cultivating loving kindness. Just directing the mind there. So sometimes the metta practice tends more towards just the concentration aspect. And we're saying the phrase, it's going more or less by itself, but it's just a meaningless rhythm. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. And there's no connection. It's just going in the background as we do whatever we're doing. And this is what happens when we lose that connection. The concentration is being developed. It's turned into a mantra, though. And this is the difference between a mantra practice, which is a pure concentration practice, and this metta practice. The difference is this connection. The difference is this metta mindfulness, where we are connecting with the meaning of that, those phrases, whatever we're using, and the beings for whom we're cultivating the loving kindness. There's another verse in the Dhammapada that Bhante Gunaratna, a Sri Lankan monk in America, translates as, there's no concentration without wisdom, no wisdom without concentration. But when one has both wisdom and concentration, one draws close to peace and emancipation. And that's a beautiful articulation of this interrelationship of mindfulness and metta, of concentration and wisdom. So when you're doing the metta practice, when you're cultivating loving kindness with this mindfulness, you're actually cultivating the heart in a very special way that draws you closer and closer to being awake. So you're not abandoning the cultivation of mindfulness when you're doing this practice. So just to settle the mind about that. So even though there are some very prominent differences between these two practices, there are many, many similarities. There are many things in common. Practically, of course, as we've said, the difference in how the practice is done, the actual process of the practice, is pretty obvious. In the metta practice, we're creating a new default setting simply by way of repetition. Whereas with the vipassana practice, we're uprooting the hindrances through insight. One practice, the metta practice, enters the door of the Dhamma through our conventional relationships, through conventional reality. The other, the vipassana path, enters the door of the Dhamma through absolute reality. And these are very different things. So the way the practice unfolds is very, very different. And the metta practice can actually be a little more messy, or it feels that way, because we're dealing with the nitty-gritty of our everyday lives. And the main similarity between these two practices is that they're both purification practices. They both purify the heart. In the context, though, of the metta practice, that purification, as I've said, deals with everyday reality, deals with our stories, our conditioning, how we relate to the beings that we know in our lives, the beings with whom we have relationships. So both affect purification of heart. And with the metta practice, this purification takes a particular form. And we don't say this in, you know, flyers that we send out to people who are interested in the metta retreat, because people wouldn't come. But when we practice metta bhavana, universally, everything that gets in the way of the metta, that impedes the metta, comes up to be seen. So there might be anger, attachment, any unresolved or unacknowledged things in our lives. They will come up. They will arise. That's an essential part of the practice. We get to see everything that isn't metta, everything that gets in the way of it. You don't see this so much at home when you throw your laundry into a machine and it comes out clean. But here, as you've probably seen, when you do your laundry, if it's very dirty, in a bucket, you let it soak, you squish it around a little bit, and all the dirt and the scunge, if it's really dirty, you can get this layer of that comes to the surface. And it's like that with cleaning the heart with this practice. All the impurities come up to be seen. And at this point in the practice, and this is at this point I'm going to shift the focus of the talk to something quite practical. In this point of the practice, the things that often come up for people are the hindrances, what's called the hindrances. And I'm not going to go into any detail about them, but just to let you know about how we work with these in the context of the metta practice as opposed to the vipassana practice. So these hindrances are mind states that come up, that get in the way of concentration, that get in the way of focus, that get in the way of the calming of the mind that comes with this samatha practice. And there are five of them. Many of you know them very well, but for those who don't, I'll just briefly run down the list of what they are. The first of them is desire, sense desire in particular. The Pali word for this is kamachanda. And the texts liken this to water that is colored by beautiful dye that we're entranced by. Oh, how beautiful it is. And we just get sucked in to wanting, to liking, to reaching out towards. And in the practice, I'm sure many of you have been experiencing this, it can manifest as this relentless thinking about something, wanting something. Food, conditions that are like home, or something that you like here, being entranced by a beautiful flower, So, sense desire being the first. The second is ill will, vyapada in the Pali. And this is likened to boiling water, where you can't see through the water because there's just so much heat and so much boiling activity. And this is one state that comes up in particular with the metta practice, partly because metta is the antidote to this particular mind state. And it's always so interesting when we think we don't have any anger and we come to metta practice and we find ourselves consumed by it. We can be thinking about people at home, people in our lives, people on the retreat, conditions, any number of things. This is the mind that strikes out. The third hindrance is drowsiness and dullness. Tinamita in the Pali. And at this time of the day, this is a mind state that's very familiar. After lunch, and the food here, the food's amazing, isn't it? You know, it's like we eat lunch, and then about 2 in the afternoon, it's like the head starts to nod. And sometimes sitting up here, it's like watching a field of flowers. You know, all the heads are doing this. Sometimes our heads are doing this, actually. It's a pretty universal mind state. And this, in the practice, is likened to water, beautiful clear water, that's covered by scum, algae. You just, you know, it's just bleh. And the fourth hindrance is restlessness and remorse. Udicca kukucca in the Pali. And this is, the metaphor for this is water that's whipped up by the wind. You know, when the wind is really strong, there are all these white caps. You can't see into it at all. Restlessness and remorse can come just because of habitual thinking. Maybe we're addicted to, you know, mental activity. That's simple restlessness. Maybe there's something we've done that we feel remorse about, and we start chewing on that. And this state has kind of an obsessive quality to it. And then the fifth precept is doubt, which can be particularly debilitating in the practice. This in the Pali is vicikicca. And it's likened to stirred up, muddy water. You can't see even 1 millimeter into it. And often doubt in particular can arise when any of the other hindrances are present. We sit here and we're full of, you know, drowsiness. We're falling asleep and we think, oh, why did I come here? What am I doing here? This practice isn't for me. Or any number of thoughts. I'm sure you all have your own version of this. And especially at the beginning of a retreat, these hindrances for everybody, whether you've been practicing for decades or you've just begun, for all of us, these can be quite strong. And especially in this situation where you've all come from very far away, at least, you know, far enough away to have to fly here. some people from halfway around the world. And to have time to spend a month here in Myanmar, you had to organize your life back home. You had to do a lot of work to get here. You had to, you know, really work very, very hard right before the retreat, most people. And so often what happens when we come on retreat for the first days, on top of the jet lag, there's just exhaustion. So if sloth and torpor is arising, it's not a personal thing. It's just conditions playing out. Impersonal, understandable. And in all of these cases, for all of these hindrances, these are just mind states arising because of causes and conditions and karma. They're not a personal failing. They're not your own, you know, Achilles heel. Sometimes, particularly if we have a multiple hindrance attack, which can happen. You can get, you know, four of them going at the same time, or even five. it's hard to have four with sleepiness going, but, you know, you can have all of them but sleepiness going full blast. And we think, oh, you know, I'm the only person here this is happening to. I'm a failure at this. Everybody else can practice, and I'll never get it. It's very easy to get sucked into self-judgment, self-criticism. But these are just, as my first teacher, Manindraji, used to say, empty phenomena flowing on. So these happen to everyone. They're universal, and they come, they go, based on causes and conditions, not a personal failing. And as I just said, part of the thing about the metta practice that is so powerful is all of these mind states that are not metta arise to be known. So it's not necessarily bad news when this begins to happen. And how we work with the hindrances in the metta practice as opposed to the vipassana practice is quite different. As you know, in the vipassana practice, we take a hindrance as an object of awareness. We direct the attention to that arising mind state, connect with it, sustain that connection, rub it with the awareness, understand it, both in its specific nature and its universal nature. We pay attention in the vipassana practice in order to understand. In the metta practice, it's a different practice, it's a different technique of dealing with the hindrances. With the metta style, really, we don't go into the middle of these mind states. We don't actually pay them much attention. We acknowledge them when they arise. We don't suppress or push away in any way. But we acknowledge kindly, with a friendly attitude, this metta attitude. But then we set them aside and continue to direct the mind to the phrase, to the meaning of the phrase, to the person for whom we're cultivating loving kindness. We just redirect the mind away from the hindrance back to the metta over and over and over again. Sometimes it can feel like if the hindrances are very strong, we simply develop this field of loving kindness and kind of envelop the hindrance, include the hindrance in this field of metta, without going into it in any way, without investigating it in any way, without figuring it out in any way. We just keep the mind coming back to metta and the cultivation of loving kindness. And even if we have to do this 100 times in an hour, we just keep coming back, directing the mind back. The mind wants to go to the hindrance. We give it the metta as a distraction, the metta thought. Come, pay attention to this, pay attention to this. It's like training a puppy with a squeaky toy. You know, the puppy wants to go over there and we squeak the toy and it comes over here. You know, it's like that. We have to have that light attitude. And this is, even in the Vipassana practice, this is one of the first ways the Buddha speaks of working with unskillful thoughts, is to, instead of dwelling on some, what he calls, evil, unwholesome mind state, we give attention to what is wholesome. In the Majjhima Nikaya, in the Sutta number 20 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha speaks of this as the very first way of working with unwholesome mind states. Just direct the mind to something wholesome. Give it that distraction. So when we're cultivating the metta, this is what we're doing. We're distracting the mind from what is unwholesome with wholesome thought, replacing unwholesome thought by wholesome thought. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. Yeah, but blah, 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 blah. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. You know, this hindrance might be speaking to us, and we just say, well, thank you for sharing. May I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. So we pay attention in a superficial way, just by way of acknowledgement, knowing that it's there. But really, most of the energy in the metta practice as regards the hindrances, is to simply care. You know, we pay attention in the Vipassana practice in order to understand. But we pay attention in the metta practice to cultivate this field of caring, friendly attitude. So may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway, you know, no matter what is arising. So in this way, we don't feed these unwholesome mind states by way of indulging in them or, conversely, by way of resisting them. So this is not, this redirection of the heart is not suppression or resistance. It's simply redirection. And this is a really essential difference. So really, don't fall into the trap of avoiding the hindrances, of pushing them away. That's actually a form of ill will, of dosa. But simply continue to practice, even when they're present. So, for example, if you're feeling very, very sleepy, like it's late in the evening, and you think, oh, you know, I'm just really sleepy, I'll waste my time if I'm practicing. It'll cultivate sleepiness. Never mind, I'm going to bed. Or I'm going to go do something else. But really, to just put your body here. If there's sleepiness, just keep redirecting the mind to metta. Don't fall into that trap of avoiding the hindrance by doing something else. Acknowledge, recognize whatever is arising, but there's no need in this practice to investigate, try to understand, to fix, to deal with, to process any of these mind states. There are times when that is appropriate, but here in the metta practice itself, just simply say, thank you for sharing, and come right back to, may I be well, happy, and peaceful. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. Return to cultivating the metta over and over and over again. understanding that whatever is coming up, there it is. It's part of that purification process. And maybe it's something that you didn't know was there. Maybe it's something you're really familiar with. In either case, this kind of metta-bhavana reality check is actually very good news, because you see what is there to be worked with. You can access what is present in the heart, whatever it is in there that opposes loving kindness, whatever habits are there, whatever conditioning is there. It is being revealed. And this steady and patient acknowledgement that comes with this metta practice and the cultivation of the metta in spite of and anyway, may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway, eventually leads to a profound acceptance of conditions, just as they are. And this changes everything, both in our Vipassana practice and in our lives. Because there's no longer a need to change anything that is arising. What is to be known, to be seen, to be worked with. It's not personal. There it is. And it brings a heartfulness into our practice, that acceptance, that friendliness. And any skillful mindfulness practice, Vipassana practice, has this heartfulness woven through it. You can think of it, you know, as a background operating system. When we have this metta as that fundamental operating system, it's what actually makes the Vipassana practice possible. Because it's non-resistance to whatever is arising. We're not taking it personally. It's just the hindrances arise, there they are. Okay. What are they? We're no longer trying to change them. We're no longer trying to push them, you know, out of sight. We're no longer trying to blast through them to get to somewhere where we're not. We're more open to the truth of the way things are, right here, right now, rather than being attached to how we want them to be or where we want to be. We're more relaxed. We're more able to accept the presence of hindrances and faults. Just objects to be investigated, nothing personal. And we're no longer so goal-oriented. We're more interested in what is this right here, right now? Understanding that, caring about that. We're no longer fixated on something far away that we haven't yet attained. So if you're more familiar with the Vipassana practice, if you feel resistance, please remember that whatever metta you cultivate here in this retreat and right now in this moment will support the development of wisdom by strengthening that habit of metta, those habits of non-resistance. And because of the way metta is developed, because of how we develop the metta and what it is, and we'll have a lot to say about this. Because of these things, metta undercuts self-involvement. Through that door of conventional reality, we start with ourselves, but this is just the beginning. so that we have that empathetic bridge to other beings. But it becomes not about me, but about we, us. May we be well, happy, and peaceful. May all beings be well, happy, and peaceful. And there comes this beautiful equality. As we've already been chanting in the evening in the four boundless states, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. This is the nature of metta. Boundless because there is no barrier between ourself and others, because the metta is equivalent. This caring is the same, no matter what, between me and others. This is the manifestation of what happens when the metta is developed and our self-involvement weakens. The hindrances, when they're mine, can just be depressing. You know, it's like, oh, God, there it is again. This dosa, I always have this. I've had it forever. It'll take another 30 years of psychotherapy and practice, and I'm going to be dead by then, and oh, this is so bad. I'll never get anywhere with this, and so on. It can just cause an escalation of hindrances, of doubt, of self-judgment. But when we see these states as just arising conditions, we cultivate the metta, the caring. It's like, well, here it is again. Oh, may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. We're no longer focused on ourself so much, especially when we develop the metta more and more and more for other beings, and we see that everybody is subject to these conditions. We're all in the same dukkha boat, the boat of, you know, having to deal with difficult mind states, having to deal with life. And there's an opening of the heart to compassion. Because we know how it feels in ourselves, and we begin to understand more and more with this metta as those barriers break down, that, oh, all of us, may we be well, happy, and peaceful. The heart opens out of this self-involvement. So in general, as we begin the practice, as we begin this unfolding, to work with these hindrances, to work with what's going on, to keep bringing the mind back to the metta, one more thing I wanted to encourage you to do or not to do is to not overthink it. Metta is natural. When we can connect with the goodness of ourself, connect with the goodness of other beings, this is a natural unfolding. So if you're saying to yourself, well, I don't know how to connect with this, and you try to think, how do I do this? You can't think it through. It's more needed to simply settle back, relax. Relaxation is essential in this practice. Relax into the way you already know how to do this. So, for example, if you have a dear friend that you care about, and it's their birthday, and you're giving them a birthday card that says, "May you have a happy birthday," that's metta. You all know how to do this. It doesn't take trying to figure it out. It's just a dropping into that heartfelt well-wishing that comes when we connect to somebody else's goodness and to our own goodness. So simply incline the mind there over and over and over again, and there is a magical unfolding that can happen, sometimes quite suddenly. So If doubtful thoughts are arising, it's dead, I'm not connecting, I can't feel anything, I must be doing this wrong, how do I do it? Patience and repetition in this practice is the key. So that patient repetition of the phrase, saying the phrase to yourself over and over again, connecting as best as you can to the meaning of the words, but not forcing anything, is enough. Sayadaw Uindaka talks beautifully about metta air conditioning. And how, you know, when you walk into a room that's hot and you turn on the air conditioning, you don't feel the effects right away. You might not even notice, but eventually it's like, oh, it's cool and peaceful in here. Likewise, another metaphor that really works is it's like planting seeds. You prepare the soil, you put the seeds in the ground, and you just keep going. You don't expect them to come up immediately and fruit within, you know, 2 seconds. It takes time. But you just keep planting the seeds and watering them with that continuity as best as you can. So patience is really important here, and this is a quality that we as Westerners, we don't have so much often. We want it yesterday. But it comes when it comes. And so just to keep doing the practice. And it can be quite surprising how the metta can come in a moment when you least expect it, when you relax. Somebody was describing in their interview to me this morning how they'd gone back to their room and they lay down and they completely relaxed. And suddenly, everything chilled out. And that's what happens with this practice. You just keep going, and at some point, the metta begins to flow. It's like a spring, you know. At first, there's just this little bit of water, and then it flows. So simply do what you can do in the practice. That's good enough. This is what's directing the heart in a wholesome direction. You know, that Dhammapada verse I opened the talk with. Directing the heart to the wholesome over and over and over. And that's that deep blessing to ourselves and everybody else around us that the metta offers. So I want to end the talk today with a beautiful, very short quote from Alfred Delp, who was a Franciscan priest active during World War II in the German resistance. He died in the war as a result of that. I just really love this verse because it speaks to this. You do what you can, and how important that is. He said, "Light your candles quietly, such candles as you possess, wherever you are. That we do this matters more than we can ever know." So, by lighting these metta candles in your hearts over and over again, may you come to this place of boundless blessing. Thank you for your practice. And thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.